Hi, ladies and gents, and welcome to the latest Trinity Times podcast. My name is James Forrest, and I'm joined, as ever, by my colleagues Eric Knott of Read Celtic and Joe McHugh of Video Celts. Hope everyone's feeling good today. We are hoping to do this show nice and quick, to make it nice and brisk, since we had an attempt last night which failed. And we have some technical difficulties with our man in the middle, Asper. So we've got quite an agenda here, so we'll crack on to it. First up, as I said last night in the failed effort, we'll try and keep this one brief, but I was talking about Celtic's hookup with Queen's Park, where an SFA regulation means that we can now send a couple of players as part of an actual hookup with them, an official relationship. Sort of like changing your Facebook status to no longer single. This doesn't really do what I had initially thought it was, which is send an unlimited number of players. You can send three or four players, I think, on top of players that are already there on loan. You can also recall these guys whenever you want to and send more players in their place. So it will work reasonably well. The question I asked Joe and Eric last night was whether or not this would do us any real good. It's a step forward. It's a small step forward. And I don't want perfect to be the enemy of good. Progress is progress. And for me, I always applaud progress, even if it is just a little tiny step in the right direction. That's what this seems to be. But Joe, what do you think?
It is a step forward. It's a good alternative. It's a hell of a lot better than the Lowland League, but unfortunately, I don't think we've got players ready to take advantage of it. I don't think we have players of championship level. You can also have relationships with teams in League 1 and League 2. That might be better for them. One of the other issues is Celtic's priority every year at this level is to put up a decent showing in the UEFA Youth League. So that's why we found guys like Rocco Vatta and Daniel Kelly playing the UEFA Youth League, whereas they'd be better off out on loan at Partick Thistle or Championship teams. So they need to save face and put up a good showing. Playing our best players in the UEFA Youth League has taken priority over development. So it could be good, but I really don't think we've got players ready for it. The St Ninians project is putting a lot of players off. Players are coming through that and thinking they're ready to rock and roll. They're not. One small example, Lennon Miller is, I think, exactly 1 year and 1 day older than Sam McArdle. Lennon Miller's had 2 years top team experience in the Premiership. Sam McArdle's been playing in the Lowland League, recent two brief substitute appearances at Celtic. So it could be good, but I don't think we're going to see any benefit from it next season. And I don't think there's anyone ready to go out to Queen's Park and then bounce back in 12 months' time and be knocking on the door for first-team place. So a bit of realism, unfortunately.
Well, yeah, I remember you mentioning something not that long ago about Duncan Ferguson wanting to take Celtic Academy players on loan and none of them were good enough to get in the Inverness team. I mean, is it really that bad?
Yeah. Duncan Ferguson knows Brendan Rodgers. He phoned Brendan Rodgers as soon as he took over at Cali Thistle. You'd instantly think, I'll be able to get some players on loan from Celtic. It'll improve Inverness Cali Thistle. Nobody went. There was nobody ready for it. They've had 4 years playing in the Lowland League, and the combination of the St Ninians project playing the Lowland League is creating Lowland League players. There's nobody knocking in the door. There's nobody pulling up trees. Well, you know a little bit about Daniel Cummings, who's gone to West Ham. Daniel Cummings, they messed up his contract. They didn't know how long he had left in his contract. Cummings would have been better out on loan last season, playing in the Championship or League One, than staying at Celtic, scoring all these great goals in the UEFA Youth League, bringing him to the attention of West Ham and others, and he's leaving Celtic. So there's lots of management issues there. There's lots of priorities to be sorted out. But right now, I don't think there's players ready to play in the Championship, and certainly not 12 months away from knocking on the door for the Celtic first team.
What about you, Eric?
Well, if you ask me my opinion, the way I see it,
championship level.
Yeah, the way I see it is the Lowland League, if anything, regresses players. I don't think, you know, because the quality of opposition that you're playing in the Lowland League is so bad that it's only going to bring your game down. So now you're looking at a situation where we're expecting guys who have played in the Lowland League, which, as I said, regresses their abilities, I would say, to take the you know, we're expecting them to take the step up to championship level. And as Joe said, I think it's too much of an ask. It's a big step. Now, the premise, the whole premise of it and the idea, it's a good idea. It's a hell of a lot better than having guys playing in the Lowland League. But the problem is now that you have a gulf in class because these guys have been playing in such a low, at such a low level in the Lowland League. It's a big jump up to championship level. And it's like Joe pointed out there, you have, you know, Duncan Ferguson was managing Inverness Cali Thistle, and they were what? They were League One at that point, weren't they? They were third tier.
Championship. In the championship.
Were they in the championship that time? Okay, that's fair enough. But I mean, to say that guys weren't good enough to actually go and play at that time, and even to say that Duncan Ferguson was probably of the opinion that surely Celtic would have something to offer, that just shows what an absolute waste of time the Lowland League has been for our younger players. And as long as we're partaking in such a low standard of competition, we're not going to see these guys develop. We're not going to see youth development progressing in any meaningful way. So maybe this is the catalyst to it taking a different direction and possibly moving in a different direction, which over a period of time might work. But it's not going to work instantaneously because that jump is just too much. So I think we just have to wait and see what happens here. And once you know, a couple of guys have gone out on loan, it depends. Are they going to be kicking their heels on the bench? Are they going to be given game time? There's so many questions around that you just don't know. So I guess we just have to see how it goes next season. I'm sure we'll be able to follow how the guys go out, if they do go out, get on at Queen's Park, and that's the only way we're going to be able to judge it, you know?
Yeah, you're right. It's a bit of a sobering thought, though, that we don't have any players that are good enough for that level. This is the best way to find out, is just to send a few of them there and see how they get on. If we kind of get players established in a Scottish Championship team on loan, then it makes you wonder what the hell is going on at Lennox Town and whether Lennox Town's ever got to deliver on the grand promises that have been made about it. I don't know. Has Lennox Town been a success over the long term, do you think, Joe?
It's not Lennox Town. Most of them are at Barrowfield, and we're spending £10 million on Barrowfield, and it's great facilities. It'll be wonderful. Take nice pictures, but training at Barrowfield and then playing in the Lowland League, home matches on the plastic at Airdrie, playing against BSC, Stirling Uni, Civil Service Strollers, Caledonian Braves, Cumbernauld Colts, they're kidding themselves on completely. Possibly for 16-year-olds, it might be decent as a first taste of football, but there's a good few more steps needed. I would give them 3 or 4 months in the Lowland League, see how they're faring. Can they then go into the SPFL 1 or the Championship? And it's got to be promoting, pushing them in that direction. But one season in the Lowland League is going to kill players. Francis Turley came on at St Mirren early on last season and then spent the rest of the year playing in the Lowland League. You get some games in the UEFA Youth League. That's quite decent. But if he'd been sent to a Championship team last season, if he'd went to Queen's Park, then he could well progress more. But Francis Turley's basically the wasted year. He's not progressed any further. He was in the first team squad that went pre-season training in America, made his debut in that match, and then come on for the last 10 minutes, and then just kicking his heels in the Lowland League ever since.
I remember when the current Ibrox club was starting its journey through the divisions, and there were a couple of former Rangers players playing for them who were still getting games in the Scottish national team. And I remember writing something at the time thinking that If you put Lionel Messi at a level like that, you would see a regression in less than a year. A player who is a shadow of the guy who you had spent all the, your time watching. I could never understand why there was such clamour to give these guys national caps when they were playing at such an absolutely atrocious level of football. And the lowland leagues are league below that. So it almost baffled me what the hell our club was doing, thinking that that was an appropriate place to put our B team. Do you think there's a coaching problem there as well, Eric? It's not just the environment, right? Because if it was just the environment, we would at least be winning the lowland league once. And we don't see any coaching doing that.
It's like going back to the point that, you know, you guys are making about Barrowfield. I mean, we're investing millions in Barrowfield, but conversely, if we're investing millions in Barrowfield, then we should be investing millions in coaching. We should be, well, not millions, but we should be investing some of that money in coaching. And to date, it's been jobs for the boys. You know, we've had, you know, we've had Darren O'Day involved. We've had Steve McManus involved. We've had Hayes involved. All these guys who are ex-players who've got the coaching badges, but we don't know clearly, like, if they had any decent ability as coaches, as you've said, we'd be winning the Lowland League. So if we're willing to invest so much money into Barrowfield, then we need to invest a good portion of that money into proper coaching. And that means maybe stopping the whole jobs for the boys method and bringing in coaches externally. Guys who are fully trained in youth, you know, in youth team management. Guys who know what they're doing, guys who are not winging it. So if you ask me, clearly it has to be a coaching, it has to be a coaching issue, but it also has to, I think it's a combination of issues. There must be an issue with the coaching side of it, but there also has to be an issue with the level of football that they're playing. And like, as Joe pointed out, these guys are just, a lot of these guys are amateurs. They're hammer throwers. They're playing against Celtic. They're going all out for probably hacking fellas down and all that kind of stuff, you know. So it's just not, all together, when you put it all together, it's just a bad environment. It's probably a bad environment for coaches as well as it is for players. And there's just, I mean, I suppose a simple way to look at it is if you walk down to a Sunday league match and you watch it and, you know, it's so bad and the quality of it is so bad and sometimes it gets out of control and coaches don't know what to do when it gets out of control because it's all over the place. You wonder sometimes is that happening in the Lowland League, that you have just, coaches just can't control what's going on because it's so out of control, because it's at such an amateur level, you know? So yeah, it's a combination of things. There has to be a coaching issue, because if these guys were good coaches, we'd be winning the Lowland League. But then again, is the Lowland League winnable? It's so bad. That's the question. But then again, the teams who were winning it are obviously capable of winning it. So we could go down that rabbit hole as well, you know? I just don't think we belong in that environment.
No, we don't. Of course we don't.
That's the reality.
I mean, over the last couple of years, as I've been properly digging into this stuff, I've heard all sorts of weird and wonderful stories about good academy players who couldn't wait to get out of the academy, couldn't wait to leave Celtic, even though a lot of them are Celtic fans, and it wasn't even so much they got offered more money to go to England. A couple of them were offered good contracts at Celtic, but were told that they would have to bide their time. And their attitude was, well, bide their time doing what? Continuing to play in the Lowland League. Because by the time your contract ends, you're 24, 25. Whatever career you had is already behind you. Because you need to be playing at a higher level than that before you hit that age or you're done. And it's the same. I'm sure you guys have also heard stories about, you know, parents whose kids have got their first, like, offer on the ladder, and they've been gave, like, choices of four or five clubs, and one of them Celtic. And although they come from Celtic-minded families, like, they're adamant that their kids ain't gone to Celtic. It's just like, no, forget that. I've heard too many things about it, heard too many bad things about it for other parents, whatever it is. I would rather be at Dundee United or somewhere like that and got games and got a proper coach. I mean, how can that possibly be? We should be better than that. Joe, I mean, what about you? I mean, Joe, I know you've looked into this as much as anybody. Man. I know you know the ins and outs of this. It can't just be the Lowland League. There's got to be a bigger problem.
Yeah, well, I used to go avidly. I went tons of Development League matches, under-19 matches, season 2015, 2016. I went to, I think, about 25 or 30 under-17 matches. Mikey Johnson was in that team, Stephen Welsh, Robbie Dees at Kilmarnock. Kerr McEnroy was a great midfielder. He went to Kilmarnock and Spellmore at Partick Thistle. Jack Aitchison was one of the big stars. Yeah. That was the last time we had a decent batch of young players. There was nothing really for them beyond the under-17 league. There wasn't any decent loans. But for some reason, Robbie Dees managed to get decent loans. Robbie Dees went to Cowdenbeath in the bottom division, and then he was at Alloa in the Championship. Then he got a move, a permanent transfer to Inverness Cali Thistle, did well there, and he's did well the last couple of seasons at Kilmarnock. So these guys can progress. He was a strange one, how he managed to get out on loan. But there's loads of reasons. But the players born in the year 2000, and since then there's been nothing good coming through. There's maybe been one per age group, now I'm having six or seven per age group that look promising. There's no structure there. They come up from the academy and there was a development league and under-19s league, and then there was a bizarre reserve league that consisted of, the league season consisted of 17 matches. There was 18 teams in this reserve league, and they played each other once. So 17 matches is a game every 2 weeks, which is no use. So they've not been able to find a solution. They've not been able to find a level for players to play at. And that's contributed to players looking at Celtic and saying, I don't fancy it. I mean, of recent times, David Turnbull came through at Motherwell. He decided to stay at Motherwell rather than possibly go to Celtic. Greg Taylor was at Ibrox. He was released by them. Found his feet at Kilmarnock, got 100 games or so, and then got moved to Celtic. Luke McCowan, but there must have been, I don't know, there was 10 or 11 midfielders that Celtic had at the same age level as Luke McCowan. None of those guys have developed. I can remember Joe Thompson looked quite promising. He got one first team game at Dundee United as a sub, and he had a loan spell at Livingston that didn't work out, and that was him finished. He's overplayed in the League of Ireland. Luke McCowan decided he was part-time. He's working in Greenock. I think he's working in the public swimming pool. Training at Ayr United. Did well at Ayr United. Got a move to Dundee. Did well at Dundee and then moved to Celtic. So what happened to the Celtic players that were the same age as Luke McCowan? Celtic clearly judged that those players were better than Luke McCowan. McCowan went off, done his own thing, and he's a Celtic first team player. The young guys that were put ahead of Luke McCowan by Celtic, I doubt if any of them are playing full time football now. So there's various reasons. I have no idea what the solution is, but I know that playing in the Lowland League is not the solution, and we've signed up for a fifth season at that.
What a depressing subject. My fault for keeping us on that one for so long. And we're not going to move on to any happier subject here, because we're going to move on to the CEO now, the Invisible CEO. And I'm sure you guys know, I'm sure everybody knows now, that there was a podcast over the weekend, the Cynic put out a podcast, where they interviewed two members of the Green Brigade. And I found the whole thing extraordinarily informative. It wasn't just that they talked about the relationship that the club has with the Green Brigade, i.e. no relationship whatsoever since December 2023. But they painted a picture of the CEO which is not at all flattering. They described him as a guy who speaks like a politician and almost acts as if, before he answers any question, he's got to go and get permission as to how he answers it, if he answers it. how it's all evasions and never a straight answer, and it just comes over as very unengaging, uninspiring. And unfortunately, I don't like to say this about anybody at Celtic, but untrustworthy as well. Because the central allegation, of course, on the podcast is that he has lied to the supporters. They claim that since December 2023, there's been no actual official relationship with the club. Although there had been prior to that, and it had been ups and downs and topsy-turvy. And I'm on the record as saying that the 2023 ban was justified by the club if what the club said was true, was actually true. And this is something, again, that now you have to question, right? Because I don't think it's wrong to take the club's word for it and something like that. When they claim that they're reacting to what amounts to hooliganism, people barging through gates, stewards being abused, all that stuff, our own stewards, our own staff members, then you have to take that at face value and you have to take that seriously. So I thought at the time that the ban was justified. I hoped that the two parties could get around the table and sort it out. And I think I presumed that it had been sorted out, the same as we all would have presumed it had been sorted out, and that our relationship, the relationship had been re-established and things were going on as they had before. But apparently not. Apparently they haven't spoken to the Green Brigade since. And the guy who the Green Brigade holds responsible for that is Michael Nicholson, who they've tried to meet several times and been rebuffed. The way this gets interesting, of course, is that in March, we had the incident where the Green Brigade and other Celtic fans were kettled by police attempting to get to the Glasgow Derby. And so the Green Brigade section sat empty for that game, and maybe a few other hundreds of fans didn't get to attend it because they were likewise trapped for that period. The police have never justified the reasons for detaining so many supporters. They said before the game that they made a very public announcement before the game that because of regulations that were in place, that they would have the right to stop and search fans and detain anybody who wouldn't play ball. And I thought that at least sounded fair enough. But such a large number of fans and such an arbitrary use of that power, it just seemed like a total abuse when you actually looked into it properly. The upshot of it, though, is that the club had assured supporters that they were working to resolve that and they were working to get answers to that. And to that end, they announced that they'd had a number of meetings with supporters groups who were involved and the general Celtic Supporters Association and the other major organisations, and that they were taking their views on board. That came as something of a surprise to the Green Brigade and the boys, none of whom had been invited to any such meetings. They spoke to people they know in the Celtic Supporters Association who had no knowledge of such meetings. And so the two Green Brigade guys went along to the Celtic Fan Forum, that we invites only tea and biscuits sit down, which they had never attended before. But they went there to ask that specific question. And when they did, the assurance was given again that meetings had taken place, including with the association, who were sitting in the room and who again reiterated that they knew nothing about any such meetings. The Green Brigade guy said that the whole atmosphere was bizarre. It's a bit more than bizarre, if you ask me. Michael Nicholson now stands accused of lying to the fans. It's a pretty big allegation. And as I said in the piece that I wrote about it, if he thinks that it's an allegation that he can ignore, he should also be aware that in the same podcast, a Green Brigade member said that members of the board had suggested games to them where they could break the law because there would be no football sanction in terms of the use of pyro, right? So that's a pretty big allegation as well. So Celtic thinking that it can just ignore that whole interview because there were things in it that kind of don't reflect well on the CEO, they're kidding themselves on. Every Celtic podcast and every Celtic website should be demanding answers about this. This is a major issue. CEO cannot lie to the supporters so brazenly as that. And that is what he appears to have done. Eric Foss, what do you think of it? I mean, I'm assuming you heard the podcast. I'm assuming you read the articles about
it. Yeah, I'm kind of baffled, to be honest, because first and foremost, if you're going to come out with a statement and say that you engaged with fan groups which contain thousands of fans and you didn't, then you have no recourse when those fan groups come back and say that you didn't engage with them. So first and foremost, why would Michael Nicholson be so foolish as to come out with a statement like that and then be caught out so badly? And if you're asking me, who would I trust in this situation? Would I trust the fan groups or would I trust Michael Nicholson? Of course I trust the fan groups, because Michael Nicholson doesn't engage. So how can we know for sure what went on when this guy won't engage with anybody? He won't speak to anybody. He doesn't tell anybody anything. So when these two guys from the Green Brigade said what they said, and they brought up the point where they were in the room in this bizarre meeting, and other fan groups said they had no knowledge whatsoever of what was going on. I don't understand how you can sit in a room around a table and say that you engaged with fans in front of the fan groups that you didn't engage with. So if we go back to December 2023 and we look at where you're talking about when the Green Brigade were banned at that time, it begins to look more and more likely that there was a conscious decision made by the board, i.e. Michael Nicholson, to pull away completely from relations with the fan base. And that has not been rekindled since. And the next question you've got to ask is why? What to what end? What is the board aiming at here? Is it that they just feel that they're above the fan base, that they don't need to have anything to do with the fan base, they don't have to engage with the fan base? And so much so that they're willing to blatantly lie about it. And that in its own right is a very concerning issue.
Yeah.
You know, that they're willing to go to those lengths.
To add a little bit of additional context, right? I remember listening to Harry Brady on a podcast. I think it was with Graham Spears. And he was discussing the Green Brigade issue. And he said that the problem that they're going to have with Celtic is that Lowell was the guy who brought them in the first place, and Lowell had supported them. Even when he didn't agree with them, he had supported them. And that the moment he was no longer there and Nicholson was in charge, the relationship changed, because Nicholson isn't quite as tolerant, right? And I thought it was interesting that the two Green Brigade guys said pretty much the same thing, that although they didn't always like Lowell and they didn't always agree with Lowell, the relationship was at least convivial, and there at least was a relationship. There at least was some back and forth, and Lowell was willing to listen to them and talk to them. And this guy just isn't. It's just completely different mindset, a completely different way of dealing with him, which is really unusual to me. I don't know. Really strange. And the guy reiterated that they know Nicholson well, because Nicholson had been club secretary, I think, and had been at many, many, many of Lowell's meetings with him. And so they were familiar with him and they knew him. And they assumed that him and Lowell were in the same wavelength when it came here, and that's not been the case. It's very odd. It's very odd. But you're right, mate. There might be something in that. That the 23rd December ban, that might have been a moment where Nicholson maybe thought it was time for cut the cord a wee bit. Strange. Joe, what about you?
It's no surprise to me that Celtic chief executives don't tell the truth. I've got a lot of experience.
I had a few on that, maybe an angle.
So it's not a surprise, but ideologically, politically, corporate Celtic are polar opposites from the Green Brigade. So the fact that Michael Nicholson, if they were on fire, he wouldn't help to put the fire out. Michael Nicholson, he would happily see them off and get corporate seats put in there. So it's no surprise. It's pretty sad. These things crop up from time to time. But if you remember the first Glasgow derby, when there's only 800 away fans in, I think it was September 2018, there was major crushing underneath the north stand, and the club went through a token. First of all, the club said nothing had happened. Then he went through a token investigation with outside consultants and they're doing the same kick the can down the road exercise for what happened in March of 16th this year. So the club, I mean, the fan forums is a box-ticking exercise. You hear different things from UEFA. You've got to do this and that. Celtic have got two SLOs, John Paul Taylor, to deal with a bit, 50,000 season ticket holders, and who knows how many, maybe another 50,000 that go to a match a couple of times a season. They've got a disabled supporters associate, supporters liaison officer, and I mean, you've touched on the women's team a few times. I think you need to have a women's team to keep UEFA sweet. I think the fans' forums, that's to show that you engage with supporters. Similarly, the youth development in Marrowfield and all these things, they do these things because their arms are twisted into it. There's no willingness on their part to do it. All they want is your season ticket money. And there's a lovely new set of Adidas Samba trainers available this morning. So rush out and buy them if you've not got them already. And you can wear them with the four or five kits that you're going to be sold or offered in the next few months. So I think the interesting thing is the Newcastle friendly. If supporters really have got a beef about it, don't go to that friendly match. I think there's, unofficially, there's a bit of chat about that, and folks don't have much of an appetite for it. So if there's 8,000 noisy Newcastle fans and there's 5,000 or 6,000 Celtic fans at that match, it might bring a few issues to a head. Nicholson, he's not going to come out and do a Celtic TV interview after the game saying, "I'm sorry, lads, let's make it up and get back together again." But it would be quite embarrassing. Maybe Dermot Desmond might find out about it as he's enjoying the fairways of Bermuda during July. But it's no surprise that the club treat normal customers with contempt. And I don't see what any solution is. So similar to the youth development, Battlefield and other things, the glass is half empty, and that's through realism.
Can I just make a point as well, James? I'll just make the point like that. From the outside, our fan base is considered one of the best fan bases in the world. What sort of impression does it give if we have a board who won't engage with a fan base that is considered and respected so highly in world football and has won awards for being such a fan base? What sort of impression does it give that, you know, they're happy to lap up the plaudits when the plaudits come their way in relation to the support, but yet they won't engage with them? It doesn't give a very good impression from those on the outside, you know, looking in at what goes on at Celtic, that we have such a fantastic fan base, but we have a board that refuses point blank to engage with them.
It's funny and all, because the Green Brigade guys were talking about how some of the activities that the Celtic fans have been involved in and the Palestine campaigns and everything else have won us friends and respect in every corner of the world. And rather than lean into that, our board would prefer to try to appeal to Scottish Daily Express readers who hate our guts anyway and who will never be appeased no matter what it is we do. I mean, short of shuttering Celtic Park, these people will never give us credit for anything. And they're the people who our board would rather appeal to than the millions of people around the world who would embrace our club if we only leaned in the more socially progressive aspects of it. I don't get it myself. It's absolutely baffling. The way we do things makes no sense whatsoever sometimes. And Michael Nicholson must be the only football CEO in the whole of Britain who has never actually got in front of a camera and gave an interview, even a token interview, to the club's own in-house channel, which I just can't believe. I mean, I like the fact that the manager is the front-line guy at the football club, right? I like the fact that Brendan is the front-facing guy. And Ange before him was the front-facing guy. But there comes a time when you think to yourself, well, where is the CEO? What does the CEO actually do? Would we even miss the guy if he was gone? I mean, it's pretty standard stuff for a chief executive at a football club on his appointment to get all the media together and talk to them. He never did that. Patrick Stewart's already done it twice in a matter of months at Ibrox. And this guy's not done it in like more than 3 years. I really don't get it at all. And maybe the board is happy with that. I don't know. Maybe they don't think he can be trusted to appear in front of the media and speak his mind and talk for himself. But that makes me wonder why somebody like that's in the job in the first place.
Joe wanted to make a point there.
Go on, Joe, mate.
One area that highlights how a touch they are is arranging a pre-season tournament in Como with Ajax. So that is not the smartest moves. If Michael Nicholson was aware of recent history between Celtic fans and Ajax fans, having a weekend tournament in the north of Italy, neutral territory, is not a very smart idea. So that's part of the course. Nicholson, we all know the reason he's in there. He's wholly dependent on the club chairman. So he's the chairman's proxy without the charisma. So he offers nothing. I mean, he's apparently a leading sports lawyer. When Brendan Rodgers got hit with a 2-match suspension by the SFA for his comments about John Beaton, Celtic got a QC, a KC involved to defend Brendan Rodgers, despite having a leading sports lawyer. And he's on various SPFL and SFA boards. He's an expensive waste of space, and the only justification for it is he's very, very, very friendly with the chairman, and he's never going to make any decision without running it past the chairman.
That about sums it up, mate. That about sums up my own thinking on it as well. This is the chairman who has no influence in the club whatsoever, of course. We are not alleging anything else. Although I have often wondered why, if he has no influence at all, we don't just get a cardboard cut out of him and stick that in the corner instead and spend his wages somewhere else. But okay, fair enough, I guess. We've given our club enough of a whipping. Let's give the other side of the city a whipping instead. Guys, the big news of the day, the big news of the week, that the global managerial search has led them to the door of a guy who has been available longer than they've been looking for a manager. So it's taken them many, many, many months of digging around in the dirt to come up with the name Russell Martin. I know we're all having a good laugh about that. Although we're being encouraged not to. We have people like Michael Gannon telling us tonight that we should not be laughing at it because he could turn out to be another Ange Postecoglou and we will all have egg on our faces. My answer to that is that if he wants to know who is doing the bulk of the slagging this guy, he shouldn't be looking at us. Because although we are having a good laugh, we are not the ones pouring bile and abuse on the guy and talking about what a piss take it is. That would be his own fan base. It's one of those things that proves that it's possible for something to be both completely surprising and not unexpected in the slightest. Because although the forums were filled up with speculation about all sorts of top managers coming in, and the media was happy to encourage some of the more fanciful and ludicrous options like Bill Weckie's punting of Jurgen Klopp because of a Red Bull connection via Leeds, which doesn't exist yet, and probably won't exist at Ibrox in any way, shape or form, to the constant references to Jose Mourinho and how he would jump at the job. They've ended up with a former player who lasted only slightly longer at Southampton than Philip Clement lasted at Ibrox. Mammy joked today that he has signed a 3-season contract, summer, autumn and winter. And that may be the long and short of it. I am not convinced that he will last much longer than that. And I don't think most Ibrox fans are convinced he will last much longer than that. So how does a global search lasting all these many months lead to a guy who's been available right from the start? A guy who was available on the day they punted the last boss. Joe, what do you think?
I thought he spoke really well today. I really thought he spoke really well, yep. He spoke really, really well. You could see him putting up a good interview, a good presentation. It's bonkers. I thought the reaction to Fabrizio Romano's tweet on Tuesday about 11:30 was absolutely fantastic. It showed up the support in their true light. And best of all, I like the fact that all these Nathandros, they're absolute experts in Southampton style of football. They know every last detail about how Southampton played football. It's nothing to do with the fact the guy's a vegan. It's nothing to do with the fact that he's a Buddhist. It's nothing to do with the fact he's in the Green Party. He wears sandals to work. He wore trainers at today's media conference. And he's going to put a prayer mat in the manager's office that Bill Struth, Jock Wallace and Walter Smith used. So it's hilarious at every level. Your story about what's going on with the takeover, that's been well received. But the good thing is they seem to think that we're warning them about this. We're not warning them. We're enjoying the laughter. Whoever thought the banter years was going to last this long? No one did. But it's fantastic, the mess that they're in. That's from the club itself. It's from the supporters and it's from their media messengers. That's legacy media and fan media. They've all got one thought and it's just cheerleading. Whatever they're up to, it's fantastic. It's a breakthrough. So it's fun. I think Russell Martin could actually be quite a decent manager, but because of his background, he's not going to get any time at that club. Phil Clement can tell me about promises for transfer funds and all the rest of it. I think it's 7 weeks till there's a Champions League qualifier. I suspect that there'll be nobody in the current squad that is sold for a transfer fee before then. So it's largely going to be the same group of players. They might be able to buy a couple of players, but you need about 7 or 8 players to go straight into that team and hit the ground running to make any impact. So it'll be Russell Martin managing the squad put together by Michael Beale, Giovanni Van Bronckhorst and Phil Clement. What could possibly go wrong? So fingers crossed that they manage the treble this season. That's get knocked out of the Champions League qualifier, get knocked out of the Europa League qualifier and get knocked out of the Europa Conference qualifier. And then you can concentrate on domestic issues. So keep it up, lads. You've made as well great fun over the last 4 or 5 months, the last 4 or 5 years, the last 10 years. And let's hope it can keep going for a good few years yet.
It's funny you should say that, Joe, because you just know that Keith Jackson and other people would turn that into a positive. Oh, they can focus solely now on domestic football. Worry about the gigantic hole this leaves in the balance sheet. 49ers have got plenty of money. They'll pay that. We will get to the takeover and issues of that nature in a moment or two. But I wrote a piece yesterday. Nick and Jim Steinman, lyrics. I called it Russell Martin. There ain't no Coupe de Ville hiding at the bottom of a Cracker Jack box. And on the way, the story Reagan used to tell about the kid comes doing on Christmas morning, expecting a Christmas tree full of presents, and instead gets directed to the back garden, handed a shovel in front of a pile of shit, and he starts digging away, and kid from the neighbourhood comes over, looks over the fence and asks him why he's smiling, and he said, there must be a pony in here. And Reagan used to tell that story all the time, and people thought it was like a folksy tale about optimism and, you know, keep your head in the clouds and all that, but I think it was a much more cynical story than that. I think it was about people's tendency to look for the pony and try and find the positive even when things are unrelentingly negative. And I was dying to know how the press was going to spin this. After weeks of bumming up every candidate except this guy, completely ignoring him as a candidate, even though he had made the shortlist. And only one person hinted, only one journalist hinted that it might not be Ancelotti in the last week, and that was Tom English, who at the weekend went out of his way to talk about how he'd been told from inside Ibrox that Russell Martin had dazzled them at the interview. Right, he's obviously a good talker. I mean, my God, yeah, the world is full of good talkers. You wouldn't automatically put one in charge of a £50 million football operation, but that seems to be what they've done. But a lot of people are digging furiously for the pony, determined to find the coup de ville at the bottom of the crackerjack box. They are adamant that there is something to see here and that there is a great manager hiding just beneath the surface. The comparisons today to Ange, I thought, were almost embarrassing. Ange was an unknown before he came here. Ange was certainly not an unknown before he came here. Dickheads like me underestimated what Ange had achieved. But Ange's achievements were there for everybody to see. Everybody. I mean, he'd already won. I think I was saying earlier that he'd won 13 trophies before he rolled up at Celtic Park, and he's won another six since. So, I mean, Ange had a track record of success. It's not the fact is that Ange's record was either played down or completely ignored and written off as an irrelevance by a lot of people, me included, when he was hired. But Russell Martin doesn't have a track record of success at all. All he has is his 40% win ratio at three clubs. So a lot of people are frantically looking for a positive in this. But most of their fans realise that this is not what they were promised. But again, I would suggest to them that they chill out a bit and stop giving the club a hard time for it, because the club didn't actually make any promises to them. The club hasn't made a single promise to them. This is all the media inventing its own reality yet again, which is what they've been doing for the last for months since this whole takeover saga popped up. They've been inventing their own reality. And as I say, as we'll get to in a minute, this has got all the echoes of the takeover story. This is a bunch of fantastical ideas that they promoted, which bore no resemblance to reality at all and got the Ibrox fans all excited. And then this is what they get hit with. They come down on Christmas morning and handed a shovel and told, there's your shit, get on with it. And they don't like it. And I wouldn't like it in their place either, but they believed the bullshit again. They believed it. They believed what they were told, to expect a big name and expect that the Americans were coming in with serious intent and serious money and they would only hire a top-tier candidate. Well, no, not so much. They'll hire somebody who'll play ball. They'll hire somebody who will work to their exact specification. Somebody who will come in and be a head coach rather than a manager. And again, this was the other comparison with Ange that didn't stand up. Ange is an architect. Ange designs the project and then puts all the pieces, the individual pieces, in place to his specification. That's why it worked. That's why in that first two transfer windows, before Mark Law started interfering and making his own suggestions, there was hardly a bad signing. Because Ange knew what every one of those guys could do and what they could do in the team and what they would do in the team, and it was almost flawless. And that's why Rodgers' strategy changed in the summer just past there. He stopped listening to the recommendations of the board and said, I want that guy, I want that guy, I want that guy. I mean, that's how good teams are built, by managers who know what each individual part can do. And Martin's not been brought in to do any of that. He's been brought in just to coach the team and pick the tactics. It doesn't matter if the players that they gave him don't fit into the tactics that he has in mind. That's just too damn bad. That's hard lines. So I get why the fans are pissed off. It's been a long time since I've seen them this pissed off. But it's because they believed the bullshit again, and this is what they did. Over and over again, Eric, what do you think? I mean, you must be absolutely howling in your end of the water over this.
I am.
Is that what the universe you live in, man? It's mad.
Yeah, I mean, it's. You go back to the point where you said that the media built this up to be something like that it's entirely not. Yeah. And you're looking at the media today, and Ali McCoist is basically saying that Russell Martin's managerial style left him mentally scarred. Keith Jackson is reiterating the point that things may have to get a hell of a lot worse before they get any better. Mikey Gannon is talking about chuckling curtain twitchers, Celtic curtain twitchers, you know. I said I'd give Michael Gannon a little bit of insight. We couldn't be bothered twitching the curtains because we're that nonplussed about this whole situation. I mean, the reality is we'll see Russell Martin at Ibrox in September and we know exactly what Russell Martin's all about. You know, that's the simple fact. He'll prove to us when we rock up at Ibrox next September what he's capable of doing. And it's then and only then that we're going to be able to judge this guy on what he's capable of, you know? So I did an article last Saturday, it was, after the day after the takeover was finally confirmed, and I said that at that point in time, that as soon as the interest arose from Deportivo La Coruña for David Ancelotti, that Russell Martin was the last man standing. And I said last Saturday Russell Martin would get the job. Because I would be fairly confident that if the Deportivo La Coruña interest is real for David Ancelotti, that gives him an opportunity to start in a lower division in Spain, to possibly bring Deportivo up, and then challenge himself against Real Madrid, which I'm sure that is a hell of a lot more appealing than the job at Ibrox was. So that was my point on that day. And I said that Russell Martin was the last remaining candidate. And it's debatable whether he was foolish enough that he wanted the job desperately and he sold himself to Kevin Telwell and Gretar Steinsson in such a fantastic way that they couldn't help but give him the job. If you look back to where he was last December, did he feel that that was the end of the road for him as a manager because it crashed so spectacularly at Southampton? And he saw the job at Ibrox as a reprieve. It's hard to know. One thing that does stand out massively in this whole situation is he is the antithesis of everything Ibrox. He is...
Oh, that's a fact. That's a fact.
I mean, his beliefs, his image, his attitude towards, you know... not attitude, he's a nice guy. You can see that from the interview. And even Joe said he did a very good interview. He comes across... I would have said that Giovanni Bronckhorst was the last nice kind of manager at Ibrox. And, you know, nice guys don't usually cut it at Ibrox. And I jokingly said today that Barry Ferguson is your perfect... He's the epitome of a real Rangers man. And what's expected, you know? Like, Russell Martin doesn't fit into that category at all. And what it leads you to believe is that everything that was being fed back to Andrew Kavanagh, who, as we said, you know, if he's involved in the San Francisco 49ers, he comes from California, he comes from a very liberal state, immediately the beliefs and the views and the imagery that Russell Martin portrayed appealed to him. And that will give you a hint of what's coming down the tracks at Ibrox. These are the kinds of guys that the board are going to want to surround themselves with. You know, so, and also it has to be a yes man, because he's going to have to agree to the way that they want things done.
Yep.
He's going to have to agree to the budget that he's given transfers wise. He's going to have to agree to everything that they want done in terms of the way that they want the first team squad, the football squad, you know, the first team run. So, this is the first real sign of the way things are going to go. And Keith Jackson made a point today where he said that if David Ancelotti had got the job, he would have been given time and he would have been given the space to bed in, because he had never managed a first team game in his career. So that immediately afforded him the breathing space and the time to actually get things together there.
There's Russell Martin on it. But I don't know that anybody actually believes it.
No, that's time has never been a commodity that a manager at Ibrox has ever been afforded. With the exception, let's be fair about it, with the exception of Mr. One Trophy in Nine Attempts.
Yeah.
You know,
that was King, because King, he was King's blue eyed boy, and King was never going to sack him unless he had no option.
So I guess the point I'm making is Keith Jackson immediately said that Russell Martin wasn't getting any time. Simple as. And he's written him off. He's written him off already. The Ibrox board have written him off. But I can guarantee you of one thing, mark my words, the Ibrox board have not written him off. And they're going to give this guy time. They're going to give him time because they want things done their way.
Define success. Right. If he comes in, takes a couple of the players at the game, right, and turns them into like saleable assets and they make a profit on them, then perhaps that fits the definition of success that these guys have got. I mean, there is a lot of talk coming from Ibrox about a project that's going to take time and it's going to need years maybe in order to be fully realised. And if that's the attitude, then the way they define success is going to be entirely different than the way the Ibrox fans define it. Because success will be a second place finish. It will be perhaps getting to a cup semi-final. But on top of that will be success. Has he developed players? Have we been able to sell players and make money? And that will be how they define success. It won't be... See, one of the great lies here that the media has told right from the start of this process is that for this takeover to be successful, the club has to be successful. That's absolute bollocks, I'm afraid. For this takeover to be successful, the investors have to get their money back. And that doesn't necessarily depend on success on the pitch in order to be realised. The number of people who don't realise this is mind-boggling to me. Mind-boggling to me. I don't think Mike Ashley would consider his time at Newcastle to be anything other than a success. Newcastle fans might disagree. They didn't win anything in that time. But I don't think he would regard it as anything other than successful. He stabilised the club, put it on a firm financial footing, and set it up for the billionaires from Saudi to come in and buy it off him. So yeah, that's how he defines success. It's an entirely different definition than supporters have got. If they can turn Ibrox into a more saleable asset again and punt it to somebody else, they'll consider that a success, regardless of whether they win anything.
Yep. Just with last Joe, I think he's having continued technical difficulties, so we'll have to close out the show without him, I'm afraid. He's just messaged me to say that he can't reconnect, so we'll see him on the next pod.
Yep. Well, I mean, let us then wrap up with the 23 June EGM. I have done the subject to death. This was a subject that I had been working on for a week. I worked on that article for a week, and it was a horrible, awful, nightmarish experience to read through articles of association, try and puzzle out what each one of them meant and everything else. And it was a bit of a nightmare. But I got there, and I was glad at the response that it got. But as I said, this morning, I think the 23, the whole idea behind that was that I'd spoke to somebody and I'd asked them, what should we be looking for? You know, how does this all make sense? What should we be looking for? And that person told me that the 51% wouldn't be enough, that we need 75%. Getting to 75% might prove extremely challenging. Then it was, well, they've got a mechanism now for getting the 51% and probably the 75% after that. What else should we be looking for? And I was told explicitly two things. The way shares are counted and weighted, and changes to the share structure, or that would enable changes to the share structure, and changes to the Articles of Association. I was explicitly told that's the red flag. Look for changes to the Articles of Association. That's the rules by which the company works. And if they really want to run the show, do things their own way, and shut out any kind of independent scrutiny or anything, that's where the clues will be. And there were more than just clues in there. That was the full fucking blueprint. And on the 23rd of June, they're going to execute that without opposition, I suspect. Because if there was going to be opposition, it would be in evidence already. It didn't take me more than half an hour to find the Articles of Association once I realised they were going to be part of the AGM. It took a wee bit longer to go through them all and write down all the relevant points for them. But it's a job that anybody could have done at any point, and the media hasn't bothered because it's not interested. I had a bit of a debate with Graeme Spears on his Patreon about this the night before I published the piece, and he was adamant that what we were trying to do was pick holes in it, and we were desperate for it to be a failure, and we were desperate for these people to be crooks. All of that was absolutely nonsensical. All of it was nonsensical. And I thought that his optimism over it was based on nothing at all. And I've never understood at any point what the optimism has been based on, because these people have not uttered a word. They've not given a single detail of their plan. They haven't talked to the media. They haven't briefed anybody. Everything that the fans are clinging to with great expectation has been invented by the media as surely as the names Mourinho and Klopp and all the rest of them were invented by the media in terms of who the manager would be. And they couldn't even get a simple thing like the £20 million question right. The press release on that, and the £20 million is a bribe. That's all it is. It's a bribe. It's the carrot to make sure that they don't look at the stick, which is buried there in the Articles of Association. Everybody's focused on the £20 million, and even it has been misrepresented by the media. At no point in the press release or any of the documentation that surrounded it have these people confirmed that the £20 million will be spent on the team. In fact, they've hinted it will be spent on several different areas of the club. And when they sat in front of the media the day, they didn't even confirm that the £20 million was going towards the team. They said a substantial part of it. So it's not even the majority of it now. Now it's a substantial part of it. Yeah. I mean, a substantial part of it could be £6 million. It could be £8 million. Doesn't even have to reach the level of 10 million, which would be half. But again, this is the media writing its own stories and taking its own interpretation and amplifying it massively. And the Ibrox fans are just going along for the ride. And this is where they enter the danger zone, because there is so much garbage in the media. When they can't even report on the £20 million accurately and honestly, and they have to do spin and deflection on it, then it's no wonder that they're sleepwalking into this 23 June disaster. And that's what it's going to be. It's going to be a disaster.
Yeah.
I mean, once these people have got total control, they're removed from any scrutiny. They're removed from any accountability. You know, and then you have owners 4,000 miles away who can pretty much do whatever they like to your club. They can pretty much do what they want. Now, I'm not saying that these guys have got malevolent intent, but since we don't know who most of these guys are, we don't know that they don't have malevolent intent. And it's not a circumstance I would be comfortable with as a Celtic fan if this was us. I just don't know how they 100%. Can allow to get this far and how they can be so unconcerned about it now that they're here.
Yeah, 100%. I agree with you totally on that score. And it's like the old saying from Adolf Hitler, if you tell the same lie enough times, people will consider it to be truth. And since last February, the media has been telling lie after lie after lie about what's going to happen at Ibrox. And the fan base over there believes to the letter that everything the media said is what's going to happen. And such is that they're now at a point where they just don't want to believe anything else. They've been brainwashed into believing that this is good, that these guys are going to invest millions upon millions into the club and so on and so forth. And none of it in reality is going to come to fruition, especially in the short term anyway. And the first major sign of the way things are going to go at Ibrox, and the first major sign that should be ringing alarm bells, is the appointment of Russell Martin.
Of course it is.
And the fact is that, look, like we said earlier on, I'm not writing the guy off. The guy hasn't been given a chance to manage a first team football or game of football yet. He might actually be a decent guy for the job. And I made the point today like that he bases his game on a possession style, you know, a possession style kind of similar to Brendan Rodgers, I suppose, in that regard, that he believes in keeping possession of the ball all the time. But the reality is that all the SPFL managers have figured out how Brendan Rodgers does it, and they know how to counter it. They'll figure out very quickly, if this is the way that Russell Martin insists he's going to play, they'll figure out very quickly that his possession style is very easy to counter as well. So that could be what undoes him very quickly. But I'm going a bit off point here because we're talking about the takeover, not the manager that was appointed. But I guess the point I'm making is he's...
It's end point.
Yeah, he is the first.
Take something as simple as, right, his style of play is going to depend on a certain type of player to execute, right? He certainly doesn't have those players at Ibrox right now.
No.
And unless there is a substantial transfer budget available to him, he's still going to get those players.
And to then try and coach all of them to play that kind of game.
He may be a weak hand right away. Well, I mean, yeah, but I don't know how you're going to coach John Souter to be good at that. I don't know how you're going to coach Jack Butland to be good at it. And right there's your starting blocks, your one and two positions.
Play out from defence, yeah. Yeah. But that's the point I'm making. Yeah, that's the point I'm making. He is the first sign of the way things are going to go. And if that hasn't been a rude awakening for the Ibrox Sports, which it has if you base it on the reaction that they've got so far, but they all of a sudden feel like they've been sold a dud. Keith Jackson feels like he's been sold a dud. The media today feels like they've all been sold a dud. But the only person who sold him a fucking dud was themselves.
Sold it themselves, yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So, and it's like when I was reading Keith Jackson's article on Monday there about the takeover, I was saying a couple of months down, or maybe a year down the line, is that particular article going to be as infamous for him as the billionaire with wealth off the radar article, where he just painted this rosy picture in the garden, just as he did of Craig White, and Craig White was the savior riding in to save Ibrox, you know, and to save the old club, and he was going to the big bright future was ahead of them. They have no idea what's ahead of them right now. And I'm not saying what's ahead of them is going to be bad, but it's going to be a hell of a lot better for the guys that own the club, because they are not going to accept a club that hemorrhages money. They want a club that is going to be 100% sustainable and profitable. That's what they want. That's what they've signed up for. That's what they've plunged, as the media always said, their money into the club for, to get a return. And the sooner the Ibrox support wake up and realize that this is the MO of these guys, that this is what they want, then the better for them, because they'll be able to accept that this is what's coming down the tracks. They'll be able to process that and understand that. And we've often alluded to it on our previous podcast, that you want to look at a template for success, and where Celtic is now, and you compare yourself to Celtic and you want to be like Celtic, you want to emulate Celtic's player trading model. It took Celtic the bones of 30 years to get to that point.
Yes.
To be as financially stable and as comfortable as we are now has taken that length of time. So either these guys are in this for the long haul and they plan on building it over a period of time, and they're looking at a long, long time span to build the club up back to a level where it's competitive and where it's sustainable, then the Ibrox sport better bet in for the long haul, because that's probably what's going to happen. And that's not a bad strategy. We endured hell in the 90s at Celtic, but look at where it put us now. When Fergus McCann came in, if you look at from 94 on to, you know, we'd say the end of that decade, and the 7 years, the 6 years, we'd say, even up to 2000, I suppose, when they beat us by 21 points in the 99-2000 season. They were very, and obviously the years that went before that, from 1990 up to 94, they were barren. I mean, we didn't win a trophy until 95 with the Scottish Cup. It was a horrendous time to be a Celtic supporter, especially when you were young like I was and you were then, you know. But it was what happened in 94 was the foundation for where we are now. And yeah, if the Ibrox support look at it, what happened in 2025 could be the foundation for where they find themselves in 2050. And they could be a dominant club in Scotland. We don't know. But the thing is, they're coming up against a behemoth, which is a real behemoth in Celtic. The difference was we were coming up against a club which was not a real behemoth. It was built on other people's money and built on foundations of sand.
That's an interesting point.
You know, so that there's the...
And that in fact is the central point that so many people seem determined to miss. From the moment we finished the stadium and the moment Fergus had professionalised the Celtic operation, we were only going to get better at what we did. And by the time Murray instigated, by the time Murray initiated the EBT scheme, we were already sufficiently far enough in front of them off the pitch that was the only card that he had left. Because we were so financially strong in comparison to even his club. At the title, the club that they thought they had at the time, their fans thought they had at the time, that a tax fraud was the only way in which he could find the extra money to challenge us properly and to keep putting trophies in the trophy cabinet. And that ultimately is what killed them. And the thing that amazes me the most here, I mean, some of the simplistic shit that these people have been fed over how this is going to work and how these guys are going to get their profits and all that is really nonsensical to me. The guy signed all these mega rich commercial deals which will lift them above Celtic. Okay, that might happen. It's not inconceivable that we have missed some glorious opportunity out there to raise our profile and put us on a different commercial footing. But if our so-called local rivals have found the the key to unlocking that, then unless it's proprietary information they're using to do it, those avenues automatically open to us as well.
They haven't done it with Leeds United, have they?
The landscape doesn't change one bit.
They haven't done it with Leeds.
It's also going to be a bit more difficult for them to access those kind of commercial contracts than they think it is. They just signed the shut deal, of course, which is basically just renewing their contract with Castore. And they can dress it up in whatever fucking other clothes they want. That's what it is. Castore remain their shirt supplier and their manufacturer. Yeah, they put an Umbro logo on it, but that's only because Castore has the rights to use the Umbro logo on their gear. And everyone knows this is true. And that contract was signed over a year ago and lasts for 7 years. So that's one door shut straight away, right? And there are a lot of us who have harbored a suspicion for a while that Castore is none other than Mike Ashley and a slightly different guys. We all know that Castore signed the contract after the last of the so-called Ashley deals was allegedly defeated in court, but it was actually settled out of court. And we don't know what the settlement was, but Castore did a major fundraising before they signed the contract with Ibrox in the first place, and a lot of us have long suspected that some of the money that they raised during that came from Ashley, and maybe even a controlling interest or something like it came from Ashley. So we don't know what the score is there, but we can surmise it, especially since their kits are always, 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 always advertised first on a Sports Direct website. How does that happen? That seems an odd coincidence. And the fact that this is a 7-year contract with the same company, right? A company who allegedly they're not happy with and allegedly they've been trying to move past. Well, my question is maybe they can't. My idea is that maybe they can't move past it. Maybe this is an extension of Ashley's deal, just in a different guise, where there is a contractual obligation that if Castore match the highest bid that's on the table, they get the contract. It's exactly the same deal Ashley had. And so Castore there for at least the next 6 years, the next 5-6 years, and maybe even beyond that. So that's one avenue closed. The short sponsorship deal, I think, runs for another 2 or 3 years. There was talk that they would buy that out, that Red Bull would come in and buy that out. So let me see if I understand this. Red Bull only just going to pay an overinflated fee to get their names on the shirt. But on top of that overinflated fee, they're also going to pay an additional fee to buy out the current deal. That makes no commercial sense from Red Bull's point of view at all. At all. It's called cuckoo land stuff. But it was an idea that was floated by some journalist or some guy on an Ibrox fan forum. And all of a sudden that one to Red Bull grew its wings, right? And it's nonsensical. There's zero chance of that happening. Right. So what does it leave you with? It leaves you with stadium naming rights, which they've already said that is not part of the plan, but you wait and see how quickly that becomes part of the plan a year down the line, or after 23 June when this AGM gives them the power to do whatever they want. You wait and see how quickly that one becomes part of the plan. That is a stonewall certainty to happen.
Do you know what I feel sorry for in all of this? Or, you know, I feel sorry for the Loving Cup. I don't know what's going to happen to the Loving Cup. what's Russell Martin going to do with the Loving Cup?
Yeah. So when you exclude that, when you exclude the shirt deal, which is impossible for a couple of years, and a kit deal, which is impossible for the next 5 or 6 years, you're not really left with an awful lot of avenues. Some commercial tie-in with the 49ers might have been possible if this was the 49ers who were in charge of the club, but it isn't. And this is another misconception that appears all the time. The media loves to promote this as a 49ers takeover. Andrew Kavanagh has no formal connection with the 49ers, and he's the guy fronting this deal. The 49ers have been brought in, yes, they're part of the consortium, but part of the consortium is the operative phrase here. Certainly they want a return on their money. And that's why Marath is on the board. That's why they've got interest in who the manager is and how the the signing system is going to work and the player development model. That's what they're in it for. They're protecting an investment. They're not running it. They're not in charge. The guys who are in charge are hidden behind that Delaware-based LLC. And this has already been admitted. Chris Jack, in his first Q&A with the board, one at the weekend when the takeover was signed, he said, yeah, there are unnamed parties to this deal. There are members of the wee coalition, the wee group who've done the deal, who will not be named. Of course they won't be named. They'll never be named, but they're running the show. You better believe that they're not silent partners. They're running this whole thing. And Kavanaugh's their front guy, and that's what he's doing in this. Otherwise, he wouldn't be near this. The 49ers don't need him. He's not a football guy. He brings nothing to the table. He's not an expert in any way, shape, or form in anything that these guys are doing.
I'll wager one thing, though, James. I bet he likes Buddhists.
He must.
I bet he likes guys who wear trainers.
The walks are now in total charge over there. They're now in control. And the interesting thing for me is going to be how they react to the first crazy Ying and Bratz banner. I think life could get very interesting very fast there.
It's going to be a roller coaster of a season next season, definitely.
I mean, there are enough warning signs and enough warning lights flashing that even these people should be able to see them. As I said, I am not saying that these people have got malign intent. But since we don't know who most of these people are or what it is that they want or how the money was raised to fund the deal or how they intend to recoup their investment, we don't know that they don't have malign intent. Neither do the Ibrox fans. And the 23rd of June, those people can do whatever they like to their club. Whatever they like.
No questions asked
because nobody will be allowed to ask the questions. And even if there were questions and even if those questions get answers, no one's entitled to see the minutes who isn't approved by the board. So you'll never know any of it. UEFA will know. See, this was suggested to me when I was writing the piece. Maybe this is a mechanism to hide the actual names of the investors from UEFA. Maybe this is the 49ers and the different guys. Well, first, the 49ers wouldn't have to do that because they haven't done it with their club in Belgium. They've not had to declare. They've not had to hide their involvement there. They have Marathi on the board anyway at Ibrox, so they're not hiding their involvement in any way, shape or form. If they had some control and interest, they wouldn't need to hide that either. They would only have to do what the two Red Bull teams have done and structure the two boards in such a way as there was no overlap. And there is an overlap. So it just seems like a bizarre way for them to do it. But in actual fact, it would make no difference. Because although we won't find out who the investors are, and although the Ibrox fans won't find out who the investors are, UEFA will find out who the investors are. Because the club does have to declare that to them. So they'll know stuff that the rest of us don't. And if they've got no problem with it, and why would they have a problem with it unless there was some gigantic conflict of interest? If somebody wants to loot a football club, they're not going to care as long as it's looted within their rules and regulations. They don't give a damn. You know, selling lease back to the stadium won't matter to UEFA. They don't care who owns the stadium. As long as the club can functionally use it to play in their competitions, they don't care. So the whole thing's mad to me that the Ibrox fans have subjected their club to this level of risk. But see,
this is the problem, James. It's the media, as we said earlier on, brainwashes the Ibrox support, and they believe everything that the media writes as gospel because that's what they're used to. They're used to the media being their mouthpiece. And that everything that the media says they consider to be the truth. And they're brainwashed. And they're brainwashed so much into believing, just as they were with Craig White.
They should know better than that. The same media sold them Craig White as a billionaire and Charles Green as a saviour.
Yeah.
You know, every one of our
forums. Yeah, but if you keep selling people the same crap.
Dave King. Anybody can sell Dave King as a saviour? I don't know, but they did it.
But that's my point. If you keep selling people the same crap over and over again, they're going to keep believing it.
Yeah.
And it's... Look, we could go on about it all night, and it's not going to change the fact that they haven't asked enough questions. If the shoe was on the other foot and it was our club, we would be asking hard questions. We wouldn't be letting it happen. And we'd be asking hard questions across the board about every aspect of it. We'd want to know every facet of it.
Yeah, but...
And no stone would be left unturned. So, look.
I don't think we would have sleepwalked into something of this magnitude. I genuinely don't. No. I know there's a lot of Celtic fans who, if we were being targeted for a takeover of this type, would only see that are positives and would only think about the money and would only think about the possibilities and all that. And they wouldn't be terribly concerned with due diligence, but enough of us would be. Enough of us would be screaming from the fucking rafters that this was crazy and this was insane. And none of them, that's the thing, none of them are doing it. None of them. Yeah.
The reality is, though, that our board is never going to let go of the club. You know, they're never going to. It's going to be years before we see a change in that level. You know, so it's not going to change. And while I said in an article I wrote, it's better the devil you know than the devil you don't. We know the devil at Celtic Park. We know who we're dealing with. We know what to expect. It doesn't change. You know, whereas at Ibrox, they do not know the devil. They don't know what they've taken on here. I think they're going to have a real rude awakening and a reality check pretty soon as to what's going to be happening there. And the start of it was the hiring of Russell Martin. You know?
Yeah. Here's where I'll shut up and let us both get on with our night, right? The thing I've never understood about this is there is an obvious truth here. Which is simultaneously being acknowledged and ignored by the media, which I 1984 is probably the best book that's ever been written, right? With the notable exception of The Lord of the Rings. I read both of them every single year, at least once. And 1984 is definitely the most prescient novel that's ever been written. And when Winston Smith is explaining doublethink, it is still the quote that I use over and over again to sum up the Scottish media, the ability to hold two contradictory ideas in your head at the same time and believe in them both, knowing that they cancel each other out, right? And I never cease to be amazed at the media's ability to do that. It's phenomenal. Really is something to see. Because there's one absolutely obvious fact that they are all determined to ignore. They talk about how the new investors will bring more money into the club and let the club spend more money. And they will make it more professional. Right, okay, that's fine. But what you're asking, what they're really asking for there, of course, is a club that already spends too much money to spend more money, right? And that is not running it professionally. So if you want it run professionally, and if these guys are coming in to see profits, then running it professionally means spending less money and not more. And I've never quite understood where the failure to grasp that simple fact of economics is. In order to professionalise the club, they have to cut the cost base first. They have to eliminate wastage and overspend wherever they can find it and get it on a sound financial footing so it's no losing £17 million every year. And only once you do that can you start rebuilding the foundation, a task which in itself is gargantuan and will take a long time. But you need to retool it first, and you don't retool it by spending more money on it. This blows my mind. They cannot grasp the simple economic factor that, and that just amazes me. The assumption is that what the club needs is an influx of money. But the problem the club has is it already spends too much money.
Yeah, but that's why the message has been sent out already by the board that this may get worse before it gets better. These guys aren't lying to them.
No,
and we've made that point. We've made the point that they haven't lied to them throughout this whole process. It's the media that's been lying the whole time. Well, it's the media that's just been making up bullshit the whole time. But these guys have never lied. They've never, as you said, been malicious in the way that they've done their dealings at this club. They've been upfront, and they've said it may get worse before it gets better. And in order for it to get worse, that means
you had with the media and told them that.
Yeah. And in order for it to get worse, that involves cutting costs. It's that simple. So you made the point there about 1984 and Lord of the Flies. part of my school curriculum when I was a kid was Lord of the Flies and George Orwell's Animal Farm.
Oh, yeah.
And one little saying out of Animal Farm that always sticks with me and applies to the Celtic board is some animals are equal, all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others.
Yeah, Mr. Orwell's Animal Farm has that's
how I perceive the Celtic board.
I think that is a very good point. And I'll tell you what, listening to that Green Brigade podcast, you cannot be in any doubt about that at all. You cannot be in any doubt. I remember a meeting I had with Lowell once where he talked about, and it was clear from the way he was talking, right, that he was, I don't know if he was wholly aware that he was, the impression that he was telegraphing, right? He talked about how their fans are absolutely unquestioning fools and will believe any amount of stuff that they get told by their board of directors, where the Celtic fans are constantly on his back and they're always demanding men and they're always demanding answers to questions that I don't even see why they have to, right? And I'm thinking to myself, I don't know if you think you're making a statement about the Ibrox board and the Ibrox fans all being, you know, part of the same clown car, but what you're actually saying to me is that you wish our fans were more like theirs.
Yeah.
And that's how it's always, anytime I've ever thought about it, that's how I thought of it.
Yeah. And that's why
you wish we were more like them.
Yeah. And that's why I associate that slogan. Yeah. All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. And that's how the board perceive themselves when it comes to the fan base at Celtic, you know? And that's going back to what we were discussing earlier on about Michael Nicholson. They believe themselves to be above the fan base. Yeah. So look, we'll have to wrap it.
This hasn't been bad, mate, for a show that we've done half of on our own.
Yeah. We'll wrap it up.
Mr. McEwen has technical problems. My God.
Well, we'll announce to everybody
hopefully as of next time, his problems will be solved. There is a solution.
Well, he's going to have shiny new broadband installed, so we should.
There is a solution. So I want to thank everybody who's listened to all three of us tonight, and then all two of us. There is a little bell on your YouTube page, and if you press that little bell, you will get notifications every single time we publish one of these or whenever we go live. I think we're going to be back on a live schedule before long. This one's been recorded because it's been, to be frank, an absolute nightmare trying to get us all together. And even when we are all together, there's no guarantee that we can all stay on together.
Yeah, Joe's going to parachute off.
Yep. So we're working on these things, and we're going to have a lot more for you over the summer. This will not be a quiet summer, I don't think, by any stretch of the imagination. If there's no stuff happening in Celtic, it will be happening elsewhere, and it sounds like there could be a lot happening elsewhere. So thank you all for joining us, guys, and we will see you on the next show. And thanks to my colleague who's still here, and the one who's gone, for joining us in the first place.
Okay, cheers, guys. See you next week. Bye-bye.